This is the Tom Hartman Program on AirAmericaRadio.com.
Welcome to the Tom Hartman Program.
Tom Hartman.
Truth in Broadcasting.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. And with us, our first guest today. We're, by the way, in the second hour of our program, I want to get into this whole issue of what should Democrats do in the Michigan primary? And what have Republicans done in the Michigan primary in the past? Should be a fascinating conversation. But first, perhaps one of the strongest arguments for national health care, the idea that all liberals are mad, suffering from mental illness. And there's a lot of liberals out there, so I'm assuming Dr. Lyle Rossiter, Jr., the author of The Liberal Mind, The Psychological Causes of Political Madness, that you are an advocate of mass mental health providing.
Not quite. At least not at government expense. No, what I can tell you what the book is about, but I think it's important to correct any misconceptions about what my opinions are, that I distinguish between the benign and the radical liberal mind. I'm in no sense saying that all liberals are mentally ill. I don't even use that term. I use terms like irrational beliefs or neurosis and that sort of thing, but not toward the benign liberal mind. Most liberals are reasonable, rational, caring, compassionate individuals who are concerned about the poor, the needy, the downtrodden, the disadvantaged, and they seek a power greater than themselves and their neighbors and greater than religious and volunteer organizations to help. In fact, as a lie who
rules that power called democracy.
Yes. Well, yeah. Democracy among well, also,
you call it big government. I would submit to you, in fact, that the conservative mind, that the conservative worldview that you're championing in your book is a form of mental illness. In your book, you start right out saying the egalitarianism and welfareism of modern liberal government are incompatible with the facts of human nature and the human condition. Sir, if you read the literature of anthropology, you get it that the human nature, human condition has always put family above everything else. And the modern liberal worldview is that we're all part of family.
And interesting.
The conservative worldview is that we're isolated individuals.
Well, it's not my conservative view, and for the record, I'm a libertarian, not a conservative. So,
well, the libertarian worldview is even more bizarre in that, you know, that it's one man against everybody. I mean, you know, who is John Galt?
I suggest that rather than treat me as a kind of generic conservative or generic libertarian, that if you read the book, you'll learn that I am as committed, as a matter of fact, to the concept of the family, the critical importance of the family, as you are, and that, in fact, much of my book is a systems analysis about the interrelationship of the individual, the family, the community, and the institutions of government. And what I do is examine the biological, psychological, and social nature of human beings.
And you suggest that because of dysfunctional families, people end up liberals.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear the first part of that.
And from what I've read of your book, and I've read a considerable piece of it here, you suggest that it is dysfunctional families, inappropriate parenting, a lack of nurturing, whatever, that leads to this need for a nanny state that is what you identify as liberals. But I would suggest to you that the conservative holding selfishness, particularly the libertarian perspective, that holds selfishness as the ultimate social good, is profoundly a mental disorder.
Well, I would agree that selfishness, and by the way, it's important to distinguish between selfishness on the one hand and rational self-interest on the other, tempered by the kind of mutuality that is an important, in fact, a critical part of my book, because as I point out, the basic characteristics of human nature resolve themselves into two major poles of human action. One, the individualist or autonomy pole, and the other is the mutuality or relational pole, and that is the pole that of human action that comprehends not just voluntary cooperation, not just affiliation, but critically altruistic concerns and charitable activities, without which there will be no freedom.
In other words, you're making the case for liberalism that throughout the book you're trashing.
No, you're misunderstanding me, my friend.
Okay, you say the rise to power of the liberal agenda has resulted from the fact that the people of Western societies have irrationally demanded that governments take care of them and manage their lives. I don't know of any liberal who wants a government to take care of them and manage their lives. And B, I'm hearing conservatives constantly telling me that they want to manage my lives. They want to tell me who I can sleep with, who I can marry, what I can smoke, what drugs I can take, what I can do, when I can do it, how much. I'm baffled by this.
Irrational beliefs are no respecter of political persuasion. There is madness existing in...
But you said this is the liberal agenda, to have the government manage our lives. And to the best of my knowledge, offering somebody Social Security is not managing their lives. But telling somebody that if they have an abortion, they're going to go to prison, or if they have sex with the wrong person, they're going to go to prison, or if they smoke, something that grew in their backyard, they're going to go to prison. That's managing their lives.
I agree with you, and I think that's irrational. I think it's contrary to one of the things that's struck me about your website and a couple of things that I've read of yours is that you're interested in restoring the original American vision. I'm all for it. And if there is excessive regulation on the conservative side and excessive regulation on the liberal side, both are wrong.
Well, then why this kind of... We're talking with Dr. Lyle Rossiter. He's the author of The Liberal Mind, The Psychological Causes of Political Madness, his book, LibertyMind.com. In your book, you write, "Those who occupy... When the liberal mind is passionate, what the liberal mind is passionate about is a world filled with pity, sorrow, neediness, misfortune, poverty, suspicion, mistrust, anger, exploitation, discrimination, victimization, and alienation and injustice. Those who occupy this world are workers," and you put that in quotes. You're not familiar with the 200-year history of the labor movement against the mentally ill robber barons?
I'm familiar with the 200-year labor movement, of course. I would not.
And you say workers are mentally ill?
No. I've already stated earlier. Let me state again for you and for your listeners that I don't use the term mentally ill to talk about robber barons or you or anybody else in particular. I use different terminology, and I'm very explicit in the book regarding where I think the differences are between the benign liberal mind, who very appropriately feels compassion, who has, in fact, holds fundamental liberty rights beliefs, the kinds of basic laws and rights and duties and obligations that defined this fantastic country of ours, founded on principles of ordered liberty. There's no question about it.
Well, then why, Dr. Rossiter, did you write, for example, this is in your chapter on the appeal of modern liberalism, you say, rather than praying to a higher power to strengthen and guide us in our personal labors and serve others as we serve ourselves, we plead to our legislators for a place at the public trough and hope that they will do unto us at least as generously as they do unto others. Essentially, what you're saying is, just pick that cotton out there, and don't worry, when you die, you'll get to heaven. Whereas liberals would say, hey, wait a minute, this is a democratic republic. We are all in this together, and if somebody among us is exploited, it is our collective obligation to stop the exploiters.
Well, first of all, you're running with the ball in interpreting what I'm saying. You keep misstating.
I quoted you verbatim.
No. But you go beyond what the meaning of the quoted words and put your own interpretation to it. That's your business.
Well, your next sentence: big government revenue has in effect become the income of the very large family whose children vie for indulgences, while ready at any moment to protest in the name of egalitarianism if one sibling seems to be getting more than another.
Right. I mean, and listen to the news, listen to campaign rhetoric, listen to people who are brought out by the various candidates to tell their story, and what you get is a panoply of programs designed to respond to virtually every human difficulty.
Are you talking about the big oil industry executives who came before Congress and begged for $8 billion? Is that or the tobacco industry executives who swore an oath before God that tobacco is not addictive and wanted more money?
As a libertarian, my friend, big industry.
Big industry is fine with libertarians.
Hold on, let me finish now.
If you can stick around, I'll let you finish after the break.
Oh, sure.
I'll give you a good shot at it here.
Okay.
Dr. Lyle Rossiter is with us. He's the author of The Liberal Mind, The Psychological Causes of Political Madness. His website, libertymind.com. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program here on Air America, 15 minutes past the hour. Stick around.
Exposing the con in conservative. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Now I might be old-fashioned, but I believe it's true that folks around the world are pretty much like me and you. I have a silly notion if we want them to be friends, they prefer that we don't torture them. But I'm a liberal.
He's a liberal.
I'm a liberal.
Unforgivable.
I'm a liberal.
He's a liberal.
I'm a liberal.
He's your typical liberal.
Yes. Tom Hartman Radio Program, fair and slightly unbalanced. Dr. Lyle Rossiter with us. LibertyMind.com, the website. He's the author of a new book, The Liberal Mind, The Psychological Causes of Political Madness. And you were explaining to us why, in your book, when you suggest that liberals appeal to government to protect them from predators, corporate predators or other predators, that instead they should be praying to God. And I was suggesting that that was the pitch that was used with slaves 100 years ago and is used today, frankly, with the relatively enslaved in the factories and whatnot. Just keep picking that cotton. Just keep working at that Walmart. Life will be good when you die. Instead of we are in.
Hello.
Constitutionally limited democratic, representative democratic government, and as a consequence, we can do something about this.
Tom, I just part of what you just said blacked out, but let me respond to what I did here.
Sure.
First of all, in your what you said about at the start of this hour it does not adequately represent what I'm saying in the book, with all due respect. But let me also respond to some other things. I am not a libertarian who holds to the atomistic view of social interaction, and certainly not. In fact, I devote a great deal of space in my book to the distinction between, as I mentioned before, rational self-interest and selfishness, which is a version of pathological narcissism, and I discuss that at some point. The second point is that there's no corporate welfare from this guy. I hate it. I think it's wrong. I think it's corrupt. I think it violates all kinds of rules that are essential.
But corporate welfare in the United States is orders of magnitude greater than individual welfare. Why not go after that?
I have no problem going after it if I have the...
In your book.
it's 400 pages as it is. I wrote as much as I could about what I knew about. But I want to tell you that in your book, Screwed, great title, by the way, which I found much that was moving, but also your doubts about big corporations, I echo, and, however, add to them comparable doubts about big government on comparable grounds, because as powerful as big corporations are, big government is even more powerful and more difficult to get rid of. So I'm not an anarchist. Please also assure your listeners that I am not an anarchist. There's no question about the need for government. The question is how limited or how expansive should it be? What is the scope of its duties? And in particular, this is so important, what is the degree to which the government is entitled to use force against its citizens? My concern about any kind of big government program is that it subjects the citizen to rules and regulations backed up by the force of government, and it is a profoundly powerful...
No, I understand, and I at a certain, you know, in various ways, and we'd probably have to split a lot of hairs to get to this, but in certain ways, you and I are probably in agreement on that. But here, from your book, on the psychopathology of the liberal mind, You say, rather, the adult drive toward omnipotent control of others in any arena whatever is rooted in fears of separation, abandonment, loss, or abuse, the residual effects of early attachment gone wrong.
I'm talking about dictators.
The need to...
I'm talking about dictators.
Well, it's underneath the subtitle of the psychopathology of the liberal mind. You say the need to dominate others arises from the tyrant's need for absolute assurance that the catastrophic loss of dependency or the pain of abuse so devastating to him in his earliest years will not be repeated. I absolutely agree with you, but I think that this describes George W. Bush. I think it describes the modern-day Republican Party, not anything that anybody in America would call liberal.
Well, and hardly anything that traditionally would be called conservative. Conservative used to mean limited government, high degrees of freedom, high degrees of personal responsibility.
Isn't your book called The Psychopathology of the Conservative Mind?
Next book. Give me a chance.
Next book.
I can only write one book at a time.
Okay, you just a few minutes ago you said you were a libertarian. B, you know, when I pointed out that your book was saying we should be appealing to God for help rather than government, for help from oppression, shall we say, you said something about big corporations.
A libertarian
would say that a corporation can get as big as it wants. There's no problem with that. That's just fine. That's the way it is.
I'm not a generic libertarian. If you read my book, you'll find out, if anybody cares to, and I'm not saying they should, but if they're curious enough, read the book and you'll find out what I mean by libertarianism. I am not a generic libertarian. I don't know enough about your political thoughts and so on, but I would not overgeneralize and categorize you as some particular kind of liberal one way or the other. I don't know enough about it. And
I call myself an FDR liberal. I'll just put it right out.
Okay.
You know.
Fair enough.
And so anyhow, people, read your book. That's always good advice. The book is The Liberal Mind, The Psychological Causes of Political Madness. The website, libertymind.com. Dr. Lyle H. Rossiter, Jr. Doctor, thanks so much for coming on and having this conversation with us.
Thank you very much.
Good talking with you today. 27 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at
866-303-2270. And welcome back. 34 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Our number 1-866-303-2270, toll free coast to coast. And I believe you can call into it from pretty much anywhere in the world. We've had calls from Sweden and Norway and Antarctica and South America, Australia. But I don't think it's toll free from any place outside of North America. In any case, 866-303-2270 if you want to drop by our live chat room. Go to TomHartman.com. However you spell it will get you there. Click on the live chat link. And also there's a blog and a message board there, as well as over at AirAmerica.com. Jeremy in Southern California. Hey, Jeremy, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom, you're doing good. You're getting better every day.
Thank you.
If I might have about 2 minutes, I would like to touch on, the modern neocons and libertarians. I would call their mental disorder doublethink. It's interesting. I know he sort of distinguished himself from neocons and says he's a libertarian, but for one thing, let me touch on neocons for one. I think Newt Gingrich, the father of modern neocons, as he's been called, the utter hypocrisy, how they're supposedly so against welfare, but corporate welfare is wonderful.
Mm.
His county, Newt Gingrich, back in the 90s, he had the third largest government subsidies of any county in the country.
I know. I lived in that county, Cobb County, Georgia. He was my congressman.
love corporate welfare.
I'll tell you.
Look at the Fortune 100. It parallels corporate welfare perfectly, absolutely perfectly. Secondly, libertarians, they might not like corporate welfare, supposedly, but they love everything that they supposedly hate about the government as long as there's like a corporate logo attached to it. As long as it's not the government that's invading your privacy or monopolistically controlling everything, it's just fine to them. And their only friend, their, you know, their only friend in early thinking in our country is James Madison, who recanted everything that he said about, you know, giving the rich control of society. He totally regretted everything he did in those regards.
Well, I'm not sure that James Madison was ever in favor of giving the rich control. You're thinking of Alexander Hamilton.
Well, Hamilton, both Madison and Hamilton sort of said that the few should rule because the general population doesn't know what's good for them. And they said things like, you know, the people that own the country ought to rule it. Well,
Frankly, I don't recall either having said that. I mean, you know, Alexander Hamilton thought the president should be elected for life and was in favor of the Senate not being directly elected by the people, along with John Adams and the other conservatives of the day. Madison wanted the Senate to be elected by the people, as did Jefferson. Madison and Jefferson lost that argument, and the people weren't, and the Senate wasn't elected by the people until, what, 1913, 1917, 1920, something like that, whenever that was.
Yeah, I could be wrong, but either way, I mean, Jefferson basically said that if you let these people have free reign, it'll be the end of democracy. That's the one thing they have in common is that they're completely anti-democratic.
Yeah, the libertarians, certainly. Not most of the founders, but some of the founders. Yeah, absolutely. Amazing. 866-303-2270, Ken in Nashville, Tennessee. Hey, Ken.
Good morning, Tom. Hey, you know, I was just listening to that interview, and unless he was being absolutely, totally disingenuous, and I'm not going to go there, it sounds like from what he was trying to explain, and both of you, he knows the book a lot better than I do, and you certainly do, it sounds like he used the wrong word. I mean, every time you approach the topic of him using liberal or liberalism, he backed off like somebody being approached by a snake.
Well, I can't, again, he's not here to defend himself, and I appreciate, Ken, you're not, you know, going after him when he can't defend himself. But the issue or the question or whatever it is these days now is, you know, what do these words mean and where are we going? I thought it was interesting that over the weekend, Newt Gingrich came up and said essentially that the Republican Party has to reinvent itself, that the Republican Party is dead. And, you know, it's, in my opinion, very much time for the Republican Party to consider massively reinventing itself and maybe even, you know, going back to its core values. I mean, Carl Wolfson shared with me this morning. Carl does our morning show here on AM 620 KPOJ. And from the 1956 Republican platform, this is Dwight Eisenhower and Richard Nixon running for president in 1956. This was the official platform that all the Republicans agreed on at the Republican convention. Okay, they put forward this thing, the platform. Okay, the Eisenhower administration. Oh, here it is. Under the Republican administration, as our country has prospered, so have its people. As President Eisenhower said, labor is the United States. Labor is the United States. The men and women who, with their minds, their hearts, and hands, create the wealth that is shared in this country. They are America. The Eisenhower administration has brought to our people the highest employment, the highest wages, and the highest standard of living ever enjoyed in this nation. The federal minimum wage has been raised for more than 2 million workers. Social Security has been extended to an additional 10 million workers, and benefits raised for 6.5 million. The protection of unemployment insurance has been brought up to 4 million additional workers. There has been increased workmen's compensation benefits for longshoremen and harbor workers, increased retirement benefits for railroad employees, and wage increases and improved welfare and pension plans for federal employees. In addition, the Eisenhower administration has enforced more vigorously and effectively than ever before the laws which protect the working standards of our people. All workers have gained, and unions have grown in strength and responsibility and have increased their membership by 2 million. Furthermore, the process of free collective bargaining has been strengthened by the insistence of this Republican administration that labor and management settle their differences at the bargaining table without the intervention of government. This is incredible. Here he is. Republican action created the Department of this. I'm reading from the platform, the Republican Party platform of 1956. Republican action created the Department of Health, Education, and Welfare as the first new federal department in 40 years to raise the continuing consideration of these problems, health, education, and welfare, for the first time to the highest council of government, the president's cabinet. We have just supported the distribution of free vaccine to protect millions of children against dreaded polio. Republican leadership has enlarged federal assistance for construction of hospitals. It has emphasized low-cost care of chronic diseases and the special problems of older persons, and increased federal aid for Medicare, medical care for the needy. We have asked for the largest increase in research funds ever sought in 1 year to intensify attacks on cancer, mental illness, heart disease, and other dread diseases. I mean, this is the Republican Party. It's and then, of course, came Reagan.
I've always felt the 9 most terrifying words in the English language are, I'm from the government and I'm here to help.
And that's when the Republican Party went in the toilet. Claudio in Toronto, Canada. Hey, Claudio, welcome to the program.
How are you, Tom? I love your show.
Fine. Thank you.
I just wanted to say, living in a country that's liberal and being right beside our neighbors, you, the United States of America.
You live in Canada.
Yes, I do.
You're a Canadian citizen.
Yes, I am. Mm-hmm. And I just want to say this to all the people who think that liberalism is so bad. First of all, we have a lower unemployment rate than you do. We have universal health care. We have subsidized higher education.
You can go to college for free or close to it.
Community college for free, universities, and basically the highest universities, the government subsidizes 75% of the cost. We have a trade surplus. We have a lower crime rate per capita than you people. We have higher scores on our kids when they do international tests. So is liberalism so bad, or is it the corporate elite who do not want their population to be totally educated, do not want them to have the need to say, you know what, you're offering me $5 an hour, sorry, but I don't really need, I need more for my family to survive,
right,
because I get health care for free.
Yeah.
I don't have to worry about it.
Yeah,
Are your tax dollars doing?
Yeah, exactly. As long as we have health care in the United States coming through the employer, it strengthens the iron grip that the employers have around the throats of workers. And particularly in the fear of, you know, gee, if I lose this job and I've got this pre-existing condition now, it'll never be insured, and I am guaranteed bankruptcy if that diabetes or hepatitis or what, you know, heart disease, fill in the blank, ever flares up or becomes a problem.
And not that. The only thing, the thing that really is of importance, that really Americans should be looking at, the two pillars that lift up a society. I'm not talking about individuals. I'm talking a society. And if you have the two pillars of health care, free health care for all, doesn't matter if my neighbor makes $1 million and I make $50,000, I get the same right as him to see a doctor.
Right.
And to see the best doctor. And the bullshit, I was watching Rudy Giuliani's speech he gave in Florida on the weekend. And this is what really irks me and why I had to call in. When he is telling the American people that their system is the best in the world. First of all, I can't understand why someone doesn't stand up and say, wait a second, we're 29th in the world.
Mm-hmm.
Secondly.
The U.S. is, yeah.
Yes.
Secondly, he is not now eligible for, if he gets any other kind of cancer, he's in big trouble because he's got a pre-existing condition.
This is what I can't understand, why you Americans put up with this.
Yeah, well,
if I pay insurance, how can you tell me what I can take and what I'm not taking?
There you go. Claudio, well said, and thank you so much for calling and for listening to us in Toronto, Canada, on Sirius. It's spot on. Spot on. You know, Dick Cheney, if he did not have government-provided health care, would be dead, because after his first heart attack, it was a pre-existing condition. And he changed employers. 45 minutes past the hour.
Listening to the Tom Hartman Program, the No Boring Zone. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
I heard a voice. I thought it was God. It said,
you're lost, and your system is lost.
It was so scary, I was so terrified. That morning I decided it was time to change sides. I'm a Republican now. Party elect. I'm a Republican now. I got red on my neck. I'm a Republican now.
We ain't having no sex.
I'm holier than now. I'm a Republican now.
Yeah. Poor guy. 9.5 minutes before the hour. 866-303-2270, our telephone number. Richard in Eugene, Oregon. Hey, Richard. What's on your mind?
Hi, Tom. Hi. I really enjoy the THC.
Thank you.
To keep it very brief, I follow you very closely, and I've never heard you mention. Are you there?
I am.
Yeah, okay, so quiet on a cell phone. The Mass Psychology of Fascism by Wilhelm Reich, 1933.
Yeah, Wilhelm Reich, who ultimately got nailed for speaking out like that.
Right, and at the tail end of his life, you know, he died in an American prison. Yeah. But anyway, where I support Reich is in his early years, and the Mass Psychology of Fascism, is a core book addressing exactly, the guy you had on there, he is so twisted and so inflammatory in his book. And Reich, sort of breaks that down. It's a powerful book. So,
yeah.
Anyway.
Wilhelm Reich, you're absolutely right, Richard. Thank you. Not necessarily about our guest, because I don't think you've read his book. But Wilhelm Reich and his characterization of the Mass Psychology of Fascism, and that also being the title of his book, was absolutely brilliant. It really was. Sean in Sacramento, California. Hey, Sean, what's on your mind today?
Hi, Tom. What I was wondering is, when I've, participated in protests or witnessed protests, what I'm noticing, of course, and I think a lot of listeners out there probably agree with me, is just the lack of media coverage.
Mm-hmm.
And I was thinking that maybe, on your show or something, you said, you have such a great show, start a dialogue. Maybe there's alternatives. I would think rather than, say, protesting in government buildings, do you think it would be a good idea if, like, say, some of our groups protested at, say, like, actual television stations? Because let's face it, like, I've been to one healthcare protest where it's got very little media coverage.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing is, a lot of these television stations receive quite a bit of advertising revenue from pharmaceutical companies and various healthcare providers.
Yep. And I don't know if protesting at a television station will work or not. I do know that, here in Portland, Oregon, back 2 years ago, we were doing a local show when we first started doing the local show here on KPOJ. The local newspaper, the Oregonian, went, as I recall, about a week without even mentioning the Downing Street memo, and the fact that it had come out. And a whole bunch of people went down in front of the newspaper and had this big banner. In fact, I've got a picture of it on the wall here, where it says, Google Downing Street memo and shame on the Oregonian and whatnot. And the newspaper, and I don't know if it was in response to that pressure or they just finally figured it had hit a critical mass and it was a national story. It may well be the latter, because I think a lot of other newspapers did about the same time. But they ended up doing a very large spread on the Downing Street memo. So the bottom line is, I think that bringing your protest out to the media actually can work. I think it can be a good idea. So. And by the way, the caller said, thanks to the THC. Our morning show is Tom, Carl Wolfson and Heidi Tauber. And TCH, THC, that's our reference to it. It's kind of an in-joke for people here in Portland. Anyhow, Lou in Fayetteville, Arkansas. Hey, Lou, what's on your mind today?
Yeah, how you doing? I, wanted to bring up something about this, I've heard you mention it, and I don't know if you have before, about this national mandatory ID that they're trying to push through the Congress, this real identification. And I think your listeners ought to be bombarding their Congress with letting them know we don't want no part of that crap. I mean, it's just that simple. You know, we have never been a nation that had to, where the people had to identify themselves.
Your papers, please. Yeah,
may I see your papers, comrade?
Yeah, exactly. And, no, Lou, I absolutely agree with you. And the people you need to talk to about this, by and large, are the Republicans. They have been championing this thing forever, in part because, it's wonderful for corporations to be able to aggregate enormous amounts of information. It adds more power to government, and we find this very authoritarian streak within the Republican Party. And perhaps most importantly, it allows them to control who can and can't vote.
That's right. Now, that's the major thing right there. But on top of that, like, I was a policeman in Detroit for 20 years, and I know for a fact that there's no state that requires, there has never been a law anywhere that requires that you carry identification. Now, if you drive a car, of course, you got to have a driver's license. But if you're walking down the street and you get stopped by the police or eventually maybe the Gestapo, whoever it might be, You do not have to have identification with you. There's no law saying you have to identify yourself.
Yes.
And that's exactly the way we have lived for over 200 years, and it's exactly the way I want to die.
There you go. Yeah, Lou, I absolutely agree with you. And we have, and in fact, I'm going to open the next hour with this whole issue of privacy. Molly in Florida. Hey, Molly, welcome to the program.
Hello, Tom. I just want to say that I absolutely love you.
Thank you.
No, I mean, I think one time you quoted feministing.com, and I was about to send you a love letter, but I thought maybe that might be too much.
Oh, that's sweet. So we have about a half a minute, Molly, before we have to wrap up the hour.
Sorry.
What's up?
I was simply going to say that the people that are all for these mavericks, like they call them, you know, Ron Paul and Kucinich and stuff, I don't think the American people are really ready for that. I don't think that Congress as it is ready for that. I think someone more down the middle, like a Clinton, for instance, mm-hmm. would be better to ease us into that change that we so desperately need, instead of someone who's just going to run around screaming like Ron Paul and really not get anything done.
Well, now, what about Barack Obama and John Edwards, who both have political histories?
I honestly don't think that Barack Obama has the experience with people. Not necessarily the experience leading, but the experience, like, people knowing him, knowing his strengths and weaknesses, knowing how to deal with him, and him knowing how to deal with others.
Yeah. Well, that's one of the concerns that are made, and it's certainly the point that's made by the Hillary Clinton campaign. Molly, thank you for the call. Is that, you know, he's only got a year or two of federal experience, and most people don't know him, and they're just discovering him. It, on the other hand, that may be an advantage. We'll discuss that, actually, right after the news at the top of the hour. Stick around.
Uncommon sense from the radical middle. This is the Tom Hartman Program. This is the Tom Hartman Program. Tom Hartman. Where smart people get their news.
And welcome back. Three things broadly that I'd like to bring up with you. First of all, just a little news thing, a story over at tpmmuckraker.com about how the House, it looks like Nancy Pelosi is actually going to bring to the floor of the House a vote on whether the indictments? Let me find the exact language here, because sometimes it's important to be precise in these things. The contempt of Congress resolution against White House Chief of Staff Josh Bolton and former White House Counsel Harriet Myers for their refusal to appear before Congress, whether these resolutions will be, these contempt citations, will be voted on by the House of Representatives. So that's a good thing, step number one. Point number two, George Bush, while he was in Israel a couple days ago, was asked by the press, Mr. President, Can you just mentioned Iraq. Can you clarify to us whether there was any Israeli involvement in your decision to invade Iraq? And Bush said, no, none at all, none whatsoever. Then he goes on to say, remember, if you look back at history, there was a unanimous vote in the Security Council, disclose, disarm, or face serious consequences. And when he defied, now he's speaking of Saddam Hussein here, and when he defied, when he refused to allow the inspectors in, when he made a statement by his actions that he really didn't care what the international community said, then I decided to make sure words meant something. End of quote. That's the entire quote in context. Now, this is not the first time that George W. Bush has lied to the press, this time lying to the Israeli press. About 3.5 years ago, he said to the American people a similar lie.
The larger point is, and the fundamental question is, does Saddam Hussein have a weapons program? And the answer is absolutely. And we gave him a chance to allow the inspectors in, and he wouldn't let them in.
Not true.
And therefore, after a reasonable request, we decided to remove him from power along with other nations so as to make sure he was not a threat to the United States.
Now, the question in my mind is George Bush delusional? Does he actually not remember that he was the one who said to Hans Blix and to Mohammed al-Baradei, you guys, you inspectors, you have to get out of Iraq because we're going to start the bombing? Does he not remember that? Or was he perhaps not in the loop for that? Or has he said this lie so many times that he's come to believe it? I mean, he just casually and offhand said this lie to the Israeli press, that we had to attack Iraq because they wouldn't let the inspectors in. And, in fact, the inspectors were in. The inspectors were there. The inspectors were looking around. The inspectors were not finding anything that they thought would make it, you know, I mean, here's Hans Blix.
I'm not ever suggested that they were sort of willfully and consciously lying, but I think that they wanted to jump to conclusions.
He's talking about Bush.
I said in the Security Council that if something is unaccounted for, it doesn't necessarily mean that they exist. And I think there was that tendency to jump to that conclusion.
So here, you know, Hans Blix, he was there. The inspectors were there, Bush. President Bush. Okay, number one. That's one thing I just wanted to bring it up and mention. Sometimes this stuff just slides by. I guarantee you that not one mainstream American media outlet will point out the fact that George Bush lied to the international press. Now, if George Bush had come out and said a lie about a sports team, as one of my callers this morning pointed out, the press would be hysterical. Oh, Barry Bonds, there's proof. He never took steroids. If Bush said that, it would be all over the place. If Bush lied about having sex with somebody, it would be all over the place. But lying about why over 4.5 million people have been displaced, over 1 million people have died, over 4,000, about 4,000 Americans are dead, about 100,000 Americans seriously injured and wounded, including psychological wounds, lying about that, that will not make, I guarantee you right now, it will not make the CBS Evening News, it will not make the NBC Evening News, it will not make the ABC Evening News, it will not be a question that Wolf Blitzer is asking, it won't make the press. You just watch. Keith Olbermann may pick it up. God bless him. But that'll be it. If that happens. Okay, number one. Or number two, I guess. Here's number three. AT&T and other, an article by Brad Stone, coming out of the Consumer Electronic Convention. AT&T and other ISPs may be getting ready to filter. At a small security discussion about digital piracy here at NBC's booth in the Consumer Electronics Show floor, representatives from NBC, Microsoft, several digital filtering companies, and telecom giant AT&T said the time was right to start filtering for copyrighted material at the network level. In other words, your internet service provider could start listening to or reading or looking at, you know, whatever metaphor, getting a hold on, whatever metaphor you want to use, every piece of data going through your computer and analyzing it and deciding whether or not it had copyrighted information, comparing it presumably against some giant database of copyrighted information or looking for certain profiles. Now, this raises the question, in the Fourth Amendment, when it talks about papers, what does that mean? Let me just take this a step further. Adam Liptak in the New York Times back on January 7th. Here's the story. A couple of years ago, Michael Arnold landed at the Los Angeles International Airport after a 20-hour flight from the Philippines. He had his laptop with him, and a customs officer took a look at what was on his hard drive. Bottom line, the guy found child porn. Bang. Michael goes off to jail. The court, Judge Pregerson, in 2006, the Federal District Court of Los Angeles, suppressed the evidence. He said, electronic storage devices function as an extension of our own memory. Computer hard drives can include, Judge Pregerson said, diaries, letters, medical information, financial records, trade secrets, attorney-client materials, and the clincher, of course, information about reporters' confidential sources and story leads. Therefore, you cannot just routinely search a hard drive. You have to have a warrant. Well, the administration has appealed this. The Association of Corporate Executives and the Electronic Frontier Foundation are saying, no, wait a minute, your hard drive is part of your personal papers. It can only be inspected with a warrant. This is not a warrant. But right now, the policy of the federal government is that they can inspect your hard drive anytime they damn well please, particularly if you're crossing a border. And if they find something on it that they don't like, particularly something that you can go to jail for, in this case child porn, but there's a whole bunch of other things that they might not like. Gee, what if they find classified information? Daniel Ellsberg would have gone to prison long ago. The Pentagon Papers, remember? The Fourth Amendment. This is what the Constitution says. the right of the people to be secure in their persons, houses, papers, and effects. Now, I would say a computer is your papers. Against unreasonable searches and seizures shall not be violated, and no warrants shall issue but upon probable cause, supported by oath or affirmation. In other words, somebody has to swear that there is probable cause that you have committed a crime, and therefore a warrant will be issued so that they can look at your papers, and not just all your papers. They even have to describe specifically what papers, because here is the last part of that sentence, and upon supported by oath or affirmation, and particularly describing the place to be searched and the persons or things to be seized. What has happened to privacy in the United States? Now, the final issue I wanted to bring up, and then I'm going to just throw the phone lines open. I'd love to get your take on the whole variety of these things. Sir, Hillary Clinton was on Meet the Press with Tim Russert on Sunday. Interesting interview. There's a relative debunking of it over at democraticunderground.com that I recommend. But over at the Daily Kos, I find this particularly fascinating. Marcos, the Kos of Daily Kos, is pointing out that back in 1972 in Michigan, we're talking about the Michigan primary here now, the Democratic vote is meaningless. If you're a Democrat in Michigan, you might as well not even bother to vote. You've got Hillary Clinton, I think Mike Gravel and Dennis Kucinich on the ballot. That's it. And they're not going to be counted in any case in terms of delegates. Back in 72, Republicans decided that they, because Michigan has an open primary, which in my opinion is stupid, but they do. And back in 72, the Republicans said, okay, we're going to embarrass the Democrats. And so Republicans turned out in huge numbers and voted in the Democratic primary for George Wallace, the segregationist, to embarrass and harm the Democratic Party. They did it again in 1988, voting for Jesse Jackson. Jesse Jackson won massively in Republican precincts all across Michigan. In 1998, they took Dr. Death, Jack Kevorkian's lawyer, and they voted for him. Should Democrats mess with the Republican primary?
This is the Tom Hartman Program, where we dare to ask, is Walmart a person?
Minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Program. Radio listener supported radio, supported by you, our listeners, supporting our sponsors. Let them know you're listening. Give them a call. Say hi. Sponsors including the 200,000 health and hospital workers at SEIU 1199 fighting for quality, affordable health care for all Americans. Keeping our families healthy should be a right, not a privilege. Okay, so here again, I just want to summarize this really quickly. What Kos was calling for, and he started this back last Friday, saying, let's have some fun in Michigan kind of post. And arguing that in Michigan, and I say this, you know, I'm going to toss this open to a national audience, but we're on the air on three stations in Michigan, in Grand Rapids, in Ann Arbor, and in Detroit. And so I'd in particular be interested in hearing from our Michigan listeners, although right now the board is totally slammed, and I realize it may be a little hard to get through. But nonetheless, here we have a state where I grew up. I mean, I'm very familiar with Michigan politics. I was born in Michigan. And in 1951, and I lived in Michigan until 1978, and I go back to Michigan several times a year. All my family is there, my three brothers, my mother, zillions of cousins and nephews and nieces and many, many dear friends. And in 72, in 88, and in 98, in three different elections, the Republican Party in Michigan launched an effort to get Republicans to vote in the Democratic primary, to either get a Democratic candidate in 98, this was the candidate for governor, Jeffrey Figer, Jack Kevorkian's lawyer. Or in 88, it was Jesse Jackson, and in 72, it was George Wallace in the presidential primary. Republicans voted as Democrats in order to screw up the Democrats. And they were successful every single one of those three times. So Coase says, why don't we do the same thing? Mitt Romney is the only Republican out there who is spending enormous amounts of money, millions of dollars, trashing other Republicans. And John McCain, frankly, is probably the Republican who can do the most damage to the Democratic Party, who's the most electable. So let's keep Mitt Romney in the game. Let's have him spend some more of his money trashing other Republicans, including John McCain. So let's have Democrats in Michigan vote as in the Republican primary rather than the Democratic primary for Mitt Romney. That's Coase's suggestion. Now, asked about this, Romney said, quote, I only want Republican votes. This is on CNN. But Huckabee says, I want Democrats to vote for me. So you even have a Republican candidate saying, hey, Democrats, vote in the Republican primary. But for me, for Huckabee. So here it is. And Coase's points are, you know, he says you can't bring a spork to a gun battle. He says there is some concern that this is dirty tricks and that we shouldn't stoop to their level. This is perhaps the key difference between traditional liberals and movement progressives. Traditional liberals believe that politics is high-minded and about ideas. Movement progressives understand that movement conservatives use every tool at their disposal to steal power and cling to it. Now, the problem is, politics does matter, and so does the winner of elections. And on top of that, he points out, and I agree with him, that open primaries are stupid. I think that, frankly, Democrats should be allowed to vote in a Democratic primary. Only Republicans should be allowed to vote in a Republican primary. Otherwise, you're going to have this kind of a situation. So which way should we go with this? I am inclined to agree with Coase, to agree with Marcos, that if Democrats in Michigan, if their vote is going to be absolutely meaningless in the Democratic primary, a tragedy, a consequence of a disagreement between the Democratic Party of Michigan and the national DNC over moving the date up. But if their vote is not going to count in the Democratic primary, then make it count in the Republican primary. Now, whether making it count would be voting for Mitt Romney or voting for Ron Paul, I'm not sure. I would say either one. But I think that, you know, there are some interesting possibilities there, some very interesting possibilities there. Sheila, I don't see where you're calling from, Sheila. We got about a half a minute.
I'm calling from Tempe, Arizona.
Uh-huh.
And they absolutely must do this, but it has to be Romney. Because otherwise you won't get enough votes. I'm from McCain State, never voted for him. He's a warmonger. He wants to keep it going. I don't want him to win. And just like you, I'm scared to death he will. So they must do this. I've already sent them an email and a phone message that they must do this.
To your friends in Michigan?
Actually, I don't, but I just looked up the Michigan Democratic Party on the internet and left a message. Please, please, they absolutely must vote for Romney.
Yeah,
you can't. Ron Paul won't hack it.
Okay.
All right. Thank you.
Thank
Bye.
You, Sheila. Yeah. Speaking as a person who knows John McCain, yeah, he is a right winger and he is a warmonger. He's got a very nice persona. That's the problem. I mean, he is the face of friendly fascism. And he's also a Republican who has, I think, frankly, a very good chance of beating a Democrat in this election. 27 minutes past the hour.
You're tuned in to the Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
34 minutes past the hour. So how should Democrats in Michigan vote? Should they do what the Republicans have done over the last 30 years and actually have an impact on the political process in Michigan and around the country? Or should they just sit back and say, well, you know, things got screwed up, and so I guess we don't count? Interesting debate. Strange things happening in the world out there, by the way. Our crazy alert for the day. With thanks to our listeners who send some of these funny news stories to Louise. Our contact information over at TomHartman.com. Two towns in Minnesota are fighting. It looks like it's going to come to blows or go to court anyway. Over who owns the title Icebox of the Nation. Is it going to be International Falls, Minnesota? Or Fraser, Minnesota? Fraser had given up its official trademark, claim to the trademark, in exchange for $2,000 from Minnesota, from International Falls. But then International Falls forgot to renew their trademark in 96, and so now Fraser's filing an application. Also in Minnesota, there have been a lot of Minnesota stories today. Dave Carlson went to the police in this north metro suburb. They thought he was joking when he said he had a wallaby that had gone AWOL. He said, "What's a wallaby?" He said, "It's like a kangaroo." He put a thing up on Craigslist, lost kangaroo. Day after Ratchet, the name of his wallaby, disappeared, the Champlain police called him with good news. Wallaby had been spotted. Carlson told the caller, the caller told police, "I may need to go to a psych ward, but I think I saw a kangaroo go by." Eventually, Carlson nabbed a Ratchet. So, yeah, strange stuff. So, 1-866-303-2270. Is it crazy to strategically vote in somebody else's primary? Landon in Los Angeles. Hey, Landon.
Hey, yeah. I think the Democrats should be voting for Ron Paul in Michigan. That way you can get him into the race and kind of throw the Republicans into a tailspin.
If the Democrats were as organized as the Republicans were in 98 and 88 and 70, whatever the years were, I don't have them right here. In, 72, 88, and 98, where they actually got George Wallace elected, you know, who was sort of a Ron Paul type, you know, a peripheral candidate, a fringe candidate. I would agree with you. But this is not going to be, something that the Democratic Party of Michigan is going to be pushing to Democrats the way the Republican Party did those three votes. So this is more going to be a renegade effort on the part of a few folks. So, you know, we'll see how it shakes out. Here's Mary in Canton, Michigan, listening to WDTW Detroit. Hey, Mary, what are your thoughts on this?
I'm an old school Democrat, and I'm, you know, one of the loyalists, but I'm not opposed to dirty tricks. I've pretty much had it here, you know? And my thinking is, if we go in there and vote for Romney, what if he gets the nomination? I mean,
well,
we help him? He's the worst. He's one of the worst of all the Republicans.
First of all, I would submit to you that Romney is probably less likely to drive us into foreign wars than McCain. Although, you know, I agree with you, Romney's a pretty bad guy, too. But I think Romney is far more easily defeated than John McCain.
Do you think that Obama can beat Romney if Obama's the nominee?
It's going to be a tough one. I think he'd have a harder time beating McCain than he would Romney.
Yeah, I agree with that.
You know, Romney's got this incredible flip-flop record. Romney does not have the strong support of the Republican base. They're not going to get out for Romney. You've got a lot of evangelicals and a lot of Christians who don't even consider Mormonism to be Christianity who are not going to be there. They're all going to be there for McCain. They're not going to be there for Romney, you know, the traditional base.
Right. So, well, I just sent a letter to the news. I don't know if it's going to get published. Probably not. But my point is, Romney's talking about bringing jobs here. And how did he make his fortune? By buying and selling large companies, downsizing them, and laying off people.
Yeah,
he's going to bring jobs here? That's a joke.
Yeah, Romney laid off thousands and thousands of people.
But what about going in there and voting for Huckabee? Wouldn't that screw them both up?
Well,
Huckabee might be.
That's
of all of them, I like Huckabee. I mean, I would never vote Republican. My dad would.
But see, that's the problem. I mean, Huckabee is the populist. Huckabee is the guy who, if he became the Republican nominee, I think, frankly, Huckabee or McCain, either one of them, actually could have the potential to win the election. I just think that there's no way that Romney can win the election. Mary, I got to move along, but thank you for your call.
Thanks.
Martha in Grand Rapids, Michigan, listening on WTKG.
Yes, my name is Martha, and I'm from Grand Rapids. Tom, wow, I wish you had talked to some people, some Democrats from Michigan, before that you started your program, your hour today. We have a huge campaign going for people to vote uncommitted.
Right.
The,
to show that
because
right now it looks like Hillary Clinton's going to get about 56% of the vote because her name's
right,
actually on the ballot.
But uncommitted can get half. Now, Granholm and Clinton and Brewer, the powers that be in the Michigan Democratic Party, they think this is a wink and a nod. Oh, in the end, all these delegates will count. Michigan will be seated. Well, if they're right, and I don't know how this game of chicken will end, but if they're correct, I want half of those delegates to be uncommitted. We are all, the Obama campaign and the Edwards supporters, en masse, want everyone to vote uncommitted tomorrow.
Okay, so you're suggesting the Michigan voters absolutely should not participate in the Republican primary, that they
absolutely
should vote uncommitted in the Democratic primary.
Right. We should vote uncommitted on our ballot. Do not write in. Do not write
in. Right. If
in.
You write in, your ballot will be thrown away.
It will be thrown away. It's
right.
And we've worked so hard in the past 2 weeks, and I feel like my hero has just cut us off at the knees.
I'm sorry, Martha. We have mentioned the uncommitted thing here at least a half a dozen times over the last couple of weeks.
Because
okay.
We are running for delegates, and we will be committed to Obama or Edwards when we go, and everyone will know that. And there's a very organized effort here to do that. So first DECOS broke my heart, and now you, my two favorites.
Okay, Martha, you've convinced me. You're absolutely
Thank
right.
Thank you.
You're absolutely right. You've convinced me. Thank you,
you
very
20
much.
20 minutes to rub it in.
Okay. Thanks
Thank
a lot, Martha.
You,
let's move along to a few other Michigan listeners. Earl in Ann Arbor. Hey, Earl.
Hey, Tom. How you doing? Great
Just
topic.
Great. Thank you.
Yeah, I have to agree with Martha. However, in 2000, I cast a ballot for John McCain, and I won't say I voted for John McCain, but George Bush was the Republican equivalent of the inevitable candidate in 2000,
mm-hmm.
and he was being championed in the state of Michigan by John Engler, two people I detest, and I cast a ballot for McCain, and McCain actually carried Michigan in 2000. And
right.
It's too bad that the rest of the nation didn't have the same type system, because we could have possibly had a different outlook altogether than we ended up with.
Yeah. Well, this is where I believe that open primaries are not a good thing, because it does allow this kind of shenanigans between parties. And frankly, I think that the Democratic Party should be able to decide without influence from the Republicans who their candidate is going to be. And similarly, the Republican Party should be able to decide without the influence from the Democrats who their candidate is going to be.
Well, I'm voting uncommitted because this election is way, way too important to get in and play games. I would rather have a say in the outcome of the Democratic candidate this time.
Right. So in Michigan, you're voting uncommitted, which will mean those uncommitted delegates will be able to go for Obama or Edwards if one of those two emerges
right.
as the anti-Hillary Clinton.
I'm an Edwards supporter, and I'll hang up now and listen to the rest of your show.
Okay.
Take care, Tom.
Okay, great. Thank you very much, Earl. Henry. Excuse
Hi,
me. Henry in Grand Rapids. Hey, Henry.
Hi, Tom. I would just like to go along with the other two Michigan people. First of all, our Senator Carl Levin has guaranteed us we will be placed at the convention.
Mm.
We're not going to stub Michigan because we're too rich in delegates. But also, King Johnny did guarantee the state to W in 2000, and McCain took the state with the shenanigans of the Democratic Party. Also, in this election, it is very, very important that we vote uncommitted, because we do still have a lot of Democrats that are supporting Edwards and Obama here in Michigan. And we want to make sure that we take delegates. Anybody that gets any section that gets 15% of the vote will automatically be taken uncommitted delegates to the convention. And that could actually swing the election to one of the other candidates if John Edwards does not get the nod and bows out. So it is
yeah.
very imperative that the Michigan people vote for uncommitted in this election.
Okay. Well said. And I now absolutely agree with you and Martha and everybody else from Michigan. Now that I've heard from Michigan, Sean in Birmingham, Michigan, listening to WDTW. Hey, Sean.
Hi.
You're on the air.
Hi. I just wanted to say I agree with the previous caller that as a Democrat, I'm going to be voting uncommitted. I do not want to see all of our delegates just go to Hillary. I think that Hillary Clinton and her low-life husband, Bill, are the cause of half the jobs that are floating out of Michigan every day.
Certainly NAFTA didn't help.
Bill pushed through NAFTA. He signed NAFTA, and it was the death knell for the jobs in Michigan. And now we're going to put Hillary in the White House? That scares the heck out of me.
Yeah. So vote uncommitted if you're in Michigan.
Vote uncommitted and support Barack with everything you've got, everybody who's listening.
Okay, great. John in Los Angeles, California, you're on the air.
Hi. To continue to play games with the elections by voting for someone you have no intention of seeing in the White House is just being a knee-jerk responder to all the election fraud of the past, and it perpetuates the disrespect for all those people who think that the elections in this country are valid and righteous, such as veterans who have died trying to defend that right.
Well said, John. Thank you very much. And I stand corrected. 45 minutes past the hour. And Coase and I now officially disagree. 45 minutes past the hour. Stick around.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, where despair is not an option. Get active.
Doesn't matter where you are. Doesn't matter where you go. If it's a million miles away or just a mile off the road. Take it in. Take it with you when you go.
Now we need to take back America. That's the plan. Welcome back. 9.5 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Ellen Ratter with the Talk Radio News Service going to be with us in just a second. But first, I just want to get in, since we've been talking about Michigan and the vote here, two real quick calls. Please keep it very, very short. Ken in Brownstown, Michigan. Hey, Ken. You're on the air, Ken.
Hello?
Ken, yeah.
Quick point. Ken Herzog, Brownstown, Michigan. I want to mess around in the Republican primary tomorrow, too, and make mischief. But I think it should be Huckabee or Ron Paul. I don't want to give it to Romney by accident.
Okay, all righty. Thank you very much, Ken. And Steve in Detroit, Michigan.
Hey, Tom, long-time listener. Tom, I just want to make the Michigan voters aware of the right-to-work issue that the Republican special interest groups are trying to put forth on the ballot. They're hiring people to get signatures for this ballot. They are guns for hire. Please, Michigan, this is the right to work for less, the right to become a foreclosure statistic, the right to become no health insurance, no pension, and the right to not have a collective bargaining agreement.
The so-called right to work is actually the right to unemployment. Thank you, Steve. So apparently, yeah, the Republicans are trying to get something on the ballot, and do not sign those petitions. Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service in Washington, D.C., talkradionews.com. Hey, Ellen, welcome to the program.
But thank you. As you also know, Nevada looks like it, at least as the pollsters say, is a dead heat between Obama and Hillary.
And Edwards. The poll
Edwards
I saw over at TPM,
well.
Edwards was just 2 points below the other two.
Hillary is desperately trying. Obama's had organization there before. I do know that Hillary's people have tried to get volunteers to come to Nevada as quickly as possible, and Spanish-speaking ones at that.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. That's a vote that Bill Richardson had been courting in Nevada very aggressively, and now
everybody
he's gone.
Everybody thought he was going to win there.
Right, and now he's gone, and there's this political vacuum, and were he to endorse a candidate, it would probably go a long way, but he's made it very clear he's not going to. So everybody's scrambling for that vote. Interesting.
Very interesting. Also, the president today is in Dubai. Apparently the weather was lousy there for him, but he is essentially saying he's not trying to say that his national intelligence estimate is wrong, but he's also trying to, as he's tried to do in every Arab country so far, scare up the Iranian situation.
Sure. How do you have bad weather in Dubai?
Well, it can apparently occasionally get very, very cloudy.
Yeah. Well, I mean,
there's
you
some
know.
Amazing pictures with clouds and then the building standing up above them.
Oh, interesting. I mean, you and I both spent a lot of time in that part of the world. I 1 year it snowed in Israel. I've seen postcards of that, but it's pretty rare.
It is very, yeah. Very rare. So the president is really pushing on that. He comes back on Wednesday, and you know, as usual, because of the Arab culture, you're not going to really hear how he played right away.
No.
That's the kind of thing that filters down over a period of time.
No, and it's so ironic to hear or see these photos of George Bush standing in front of segregated, male and female segregated audiences where the women are covered head to toe you know, everything, unable, unable to drive, you know, no rights for all practical purposes. The men are, you know, absolutely in charge, and it's a very small group of men who can vote and who run the country, and all the other men in the country are essentially disenfranchised. There's enormous amounts of slave labor, imported labor, some actual slave labor in these countries, and George Bush congratulating them on being part of his freedom agenda.
Well, that's, that is for sure, and, you know, the issue is that particularly in Kuwait, which of course is his big friend country, you know, you have to be, you have to have been a male there before 1921. Your family has got to go back before you can vote.
Yeah. Yeah.
1921.
Yeah. Right. And then when you get to vote for a very limited slate of candidates who have been, you know, pre-vetted. And I mean, it, all of these, all of, so many, and this is not unique to the Middle East, obviously, but so in so many places around the world, these countries that call themselves democracies are a caricature of democracies. And Bush, with his torture and his secret detention and his candor reports, has just empowered all of them.
Speaking of torture, there is a great profile of Mr. McConnell, Mike McConnell, Director of National Intelligence, this week in the New Yorker, and basically he says that the torture techniques, which he says are not torture but are torture, have been successful and saved tons of lives.
Yeah, name one. You know, he also, this is the mantra that's come out of the administration, and yet what we know is that the information that was obtained by torture led us on wild goose chases. I mean, there's a whole series of wild goose chases that we were led on as a consequence of torture.
Well,
torture,
of course, you're going to name your buddy, and then they're going to bring him into Guantanamo or whatever, or your ex-buddy or your enemy, and that's going to be the next person.
Yeah. He also didn't torture. He say if you waterboard me, it's torture, but if you waterboard somebody else, it's not.
Yeah. Pretty much.
Yeah.
Exactly. I mean, that's. There are amazing quotes in that New Yorker article, so I'd recommend reading it. Also, it looks as if, I gotta tell you, I was on a conference call yesterday with the Hillary Clinton campaign. Jamie Rubin was the spokesperson, saying that Hillary Clinton really thought that she was, you know, voting for the Hagel amendment on the war. The New York Times said today that she wasn't doing that, that she was voting for the White House-sponsored amendment. This is getting down to very, he said, she said, very nasty in the campaign.
Yeah, I noticed that in her interview with Ted Russert. It really seemed like there were a lot of swipes at Barack Obama. Of course, you expect that. I mean, gee, it's a primary. They're fighting each other. But I am still strongly of the opinion that the strongest candidate of the three is John Edwards, and the corporate media will not mention his name because he's already threatened to break them up.
Well, I think that was clearly a tactical mistake on his. He should have just continued with his whatever, because he's, unfortunately, you need the corporate media if you're going to win in this country.
Yeah, I agree. Howard Dean made the same mistake, and a day later they went after him. Anyhow, Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Thank you, Ellen.
Thank you.
Good talking with you. 57 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman program. Coming up next, biodiesel, the AFL-CIO, and we'll be getting back to your calls on the election.
Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman program. Talk radio for the rest of us. The Tom Hartman Program. Tom Hartman. Defending America from the weapons of mass deception.
Welcome back to our third hour, 6 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. And Brent Baker is on the line with us. He's the Chief Executive Officer of Tri-State Biodiesel LLC. And the reality is, in this election campaign, arguably the biggest issue is the future of our energy supply. It's, in my opinion, a large part of why we're in a war in Iraq or an occupation in Iraq, why we're in an occupation in Afghanistan, why we're our military budget is $500 billion and larger than the combined military spending of every other country on the planet. And Brent Baker, first of all, welcome to the program.
Thanks a lot, Tom. Appreciate it.
And secondly, your company is one of many that are at the forefront of offering some significant alternatives to our handing money off to in some cases, Arab countries who then hand the money off to people who want to blow us up.
That's right. And we're, you know, this is a company that has an impact not only on geopolitics and our, you know, military expenditures, but also an impact on health and the environment right here at home.
Yeah, and that's actually an important one, too, health and the environment. As your website says, you know, for our health, for our security, and for the environment. Tell us about biodiesel. What's the, you know, for example, specifically, the difference between biodiesel and ethanol?
Well, I'm glad you asked that because it can be a little bit confusing in today's media environment where biodiesel and ethanol are sometimes mixed up and confused with one another. But biodiesel and ethanol are both two separate fuels used in separate engines and made from separate feedstocks. So in the case of biodiesel, this is a diesel fuel that is an alternative to petroleum diesel and can be used in any diesel equipment. So that means trucks, boats, trains, diesel-powered generator, diesel-powered construction equipment. Anything that runs on diesel fuel can run on a biodiesel fuel. And ethanol is a totally different fuel, and that's for gasoline engines.
Yeah. Brent, we're getting a funny echo on your phone. If you're on a speakerphone, if you could pick it up, I'd appreciate it. If not, I guess it's just the phone. We're talking with Brent Baker. He's the CEO of Tri-State Biodiesel. TriStateBiodiesel.com is the website. Your site points out, and this is a statistic I've seen quoted in other places, that biodiesel is only 10% as toxic or 90% less toxic than petroleum diesel. I've heard from others that petroleum diesel, that only part of what's in petroleum diesel is actually fuel, that a lot of it is basically the waste material from the refining of oil that they can't find to put anyplace else, so they put it in diesel and it ends up in our air. What is the distinction? Why the difference in toxicity?
Oh, sure. Well, there's a lot of reasons for that. For one thing, biodiesel is made from primarily from vegetable oils. It can also be made from waste animal renderings, animal fat, and it can also be made from used cooking oil, which is what we use here at Tri-State Biodiesel. So it's an organic-based fuel that's made from cooking oil rather than petroleum. And then the second thing you said is straight on. Diesel fuel has such a bad reputation here in America because for years and years we've allowed the oil companies to put a lot of the waste products in their refining process right into the diesel stream at the refinery. And so instead of legally disposing of those waste products, they're basically putting it in the fuel, selling it to truckers and letting them blow out their exhaust into all of our environments. So that's a little different than they did in Europe. They regulated diesel fuel a little tighter in Europe, and we actually have a situation in Europe where about 50% of the passenger cars in Europe are clean diesel, highly efficient diesel engines. And so hopefully America seems to be taking some steps now towards cleaner diesel fuel. But in the meantime, companies like Tri-State Biodiesel have a much cleaner diesel fuel, and that's called biodiesel. So biodiesel is made from fats and oils. It's a renewable fuel because as long as we can take care of our soil, we can grow next year's crops and continue to produce the fuel.
Yeah, I get. I used to live in Europe, and I get back, you know, at least once a year. And a friend of mine in Germany, this was probably 5-6 years ago. I wrote an op-ed piece for Common Dreams about it. Picked me up at the train station, Samuel Mueller, and as we were loading our suitcases in the back of his Volkswagen station wagon, I remarked about how it smelled like French fries. And he said, yeah, it's because we're using biodiesel and it's recycled vegetable oil from the restaurants. And it's just incredible. But the thing that brought this about in Germany, this widespread use of biodiesel, was that the German government said to the gasoline companies, you must have a pump that carries biodiesel or you cannot be in the gasoline, in the gas station business. Here in the United States, I believe it's fewer than 1% of gas stations have biodiesel pumps. And I know in the Portland area, we have a number of biodiesel companies. And one of the biggest challenges that they're facing is that gas stations are being told by their owners, by the big oil companies, no, you may not put in a biodiesel pump, and you know, unless the city mandates it. And we're having to look at legislation to force them to do it.
Yeah, you're absolutely right, and I'm impressed with your knowledge of biodiesel. Germany actually leads the world in biodiesel production and biodiesel use, and they actually have a mandate to put biodiesel in all of the petroleum. So they've made great strides in reducing their emissions. And I just wanted to step back for a minute, Tom, and tell people the big reason why we love biodiesel, and that is about 75% reduced emissions overall. This fuel in the life cycle reduces carbon dioxide, the main greenhouse gas emission, by 78%. So it's a huge savings. And another thing you hear a lot about ethanol as well is, does it take more power to produce than the fuel makes? That's not true with biodiesel at all. Biodiesel from a virgin material produces about 3.2 times the power that it takes to make it. And in the case of waste cooking oil, which is what we use here at Tri-State Biodiesel, you're talking about 5.5 times the energy coming out of that process as you used coming in. So not only does this reduce emissions at the tailpipe, it also reduces emissions in the life cycle and consumes a lot less energy than it gives up. So this is a great alternative, and it's a brand-new industry here in America. In terms of industry, it's only about 10 years old. We're only producing nationally about 200 million gallons per year, and this is for a diesel fuel market that consumes about 60 billion. So we've got a long way to go. It's an industry that needs a lot of support, and I really strongly urge people listening that have concerns for the environment, that have concerns for their children's health, that have concerns about oil wars in the Middle East, to please support biodiesel and look into this fuel, because it's a better performer than ethanol. It's a better performer than a lot of the other alternatives that are out there. It's available today, and it's really at this crucial step in its growth as an industry where we really be informed and support this fuel so that this industry can grow and become a permanent, a big impactor in our fuel supply.
Yeah, we're talking with Brent Baker. He is the CEO of Tri-State Biodiesel. The website, tristatebiodiesel.com. You're in Tri-State. You're in the New York area, right, Brent?
That's correct. We're based right here in New York City, and we have our yard in Brooklyn, New York.
So do you go around to restaurants and just say, hey, you know, we'll buy your cooking oil from you, or we'll take it off your hands for free, otherwise you'd have to pay to dispose of it?
Yes, sir, that's absolutely correct. We have a free cooking oil collection service. Actually, the guy who runs it, Spiro Theofilou, he's actually a big fan of your show. So we want to shout him out today. He was real excited about the company getting on today. But, yeah, we go out. We have over 1,500 restaurants here in the city that use our services. We have trucks on the road day and night going to those restaurants with a clean professional service, emptying out, giving them the receipts that they need. And we serve not only restaurants, actually, but corporate cafeterias, hospitals, schools. So there's an incredible amount of the waste cooking oil that is either being dumped down the drain to our landfill or being underutilized as you know, as they make.
Yeah, this has to be an entrepreneurial opportunity of mind-boggling proportions all across the United States. You can check it out, tristatebiodiesel.com on the web. Brent Baker, the CEO. Brent, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you, Tom. Thanks so much, and thanks for the great show.
Sure. Good talking with you. 16 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program, transforming the world by revitalizing democracy.
The market once made sense, but now something's off it. Since your secret meetings in Dick Cheney's office, oh, it's on. You just take and you take and keep taking, and your concern is a scam, oh, it's on. It's so clear from the profits you're making.
getting rich on the back of this nation. And W's war.
21 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Richard Trumka is on the line with us. He is the Secretary Treasurer of the AFL-CIO, the website AFLCIO.org. And Richard, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Tom. Thanks for having me on.
Great to have you with us. The Republicans are, we have a primary coming up here in Michigan soon. And tragically, the Democratic votes may not end up being counted, and delegates may not be seated, probably not. But the Republicans certainly will, and the Republicans are all running around Michigan talking about the economy. It seems a little bit, I can't quite come up with an absurd enough metaphor, chastity in a whorehouse. I'm not sure what, but what are your thoughts on the various Republican points about how they want to revive the economy of Michigan?
Well, first of all, it seems to all collectively they're clueless about how to deal with a possible recession. As you said, they're running around Michigan right now, spending their time promising laid off workers that they're best equipped to deal with a recession. And they don't really pass the laugh test. They barely acknowledge that the economy may already be in a recession. And when you think about it, working families are suffering through a subprime mortgage disaster, skyrocketing consumer debt, collapsing housing market, growing unemployment, record oil prices, eroding health care and pension benefits, stagnant wages, and trade policies that outsource U.S. jobs. And all they can offer is to promise to cut spending, government spending. Now, that's, quite frankly, the exact opposite solution that we should be facing in a faltering economy. And if we take their advice, we could probably turn a recession into another Great Depression.
I agree. Which is exactly what the Republicans did in 1929 and 1930.
Absolutely.
I mean, it's Calvin Coolidge, his campaign slogan in the 32 election was prosperity's just around the corner. Don't mess with what's working. And, it didn't quite work out the way they planned. Richard, how does the AFL-CIO advocate stopping a recession?
Well, first of all, we think that you have to get ahead of a recession. So many economists are already forecasting because the stakes for working people are pretty huge. Working people are already struggling, Tom. And so for the first time ever, and I think this is an important point to make people remember, for the first time ever, working people are not back to where they were before the last recession.
We're really not back to where we were before Reagan was elected. When Reagan came in and declared war on working people and on labor in the United States, that was when real wages started to decline, and it has never recovered.
So a new recession shall be devastating. So I think there's two ways to look at it, and we look at it at two different levels. Working people were left behind even before the economy started slipping into this recession, as you just noted. So in addition to a short-term economic stimulus, and I'll talk to you about that in a second, we also need some broad-based changes in our trade and economic policy so that workers in general can get back to where they were and start earning their fair share. Mm-hmm. Now, if you look at the economic stimulus package, what we need to do to stop, the first thing I think that we have to do is take some immediate action to stop the spiraling of the mortgage crisis. We need to be much more aggressive than the Bush administration is advocating. So we need a moratorium on foreclosures. We need a restructuring of all teaser loan rates. And we need a massive outreach by the federal government to tell subprime borrowers how they can keep their homes. We're looking at 2 million people losing their homes in the next 18 to 24 months. And that's going to be devastating.
Mm-hmm.
And then on top of that, we believe we need a short-term economic stimulus program that would invest in America for good jobs and for economic growth. It would include rebuilding our 6,000 crumbling bridges and roads and schools. It's estimated right now, Tom, that it costs about $30 billion to renovate our aging schools. Now, that's shameful. Let me give you one example right here in the nation's capital. Now, we in the nation's capital, we have dozens of schools with leaking roofs, with busted toilets and with heat that doesn't work. But there's one school called Cardoza High School, and those kids have to wear their coats in the classrooms all winter long. And in the summer, they have to choose between air conditioning and computers because the electric system has never been upgraded.
That's obscene.
Absolutely. So if we invested in those, it can be a twofer. We could create and correct the crumbling infrastructure that we have at the same time that we're stimulating the economy and creating jobs.
Yeah.
So that we can get those repairs done and we can help all those people, those kids in those schools.
Well said. Yeah, this is how Franklin Roosevelt got us out of the last Republican Great Depression. Richard Trumka, the AFL-CIO Secretary Treasurer, AFLCIO.org is a pile of great information. Check out their website, AFLCIO.org. Richard, thank you for being with us today.
Hey, Tom, thanks for having me on, and keep up the good work, all right?
Yeah, you too. Thank
Take
you.
Care, buddy.
27 minutes past the hour.
You're tuned in to the Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at
866-303-2270. 34 minutes past the hour. David Sirota has a brilliant piece out today. His column, of course, syndicated all across the United States. If it's not in a newspaper near you, ask for it. He says, for those who think the Democratic presidential nomination fight is just a two-way race between Obama and Clinton, check out this brand-new poll from the Las Vegas Review-Journal. Yep, that's right. It shows Nevada caucus race a three-way dead heat with John Edwards right in the mix. He says, interestingly, this poll comes right on the heels of the establishment viciously ratcheting up its angry attacks on the Edwards candidacy. Late last week, we saw a Reuters story headlined, Corporate Elite Fear Candidate Edwards, about how Wall Street money men and K Street lobbyists are frightened about Edwards' populist power-challenging message against greed and corruption. He also, David Sirota also says, we also saw self-anointed Democratic, quote, expert, end quote, Lawrence O'Donnell, pen a fulminating screed on the Huffington Post demanding Edwards get out of the race. Not surprising, coming from a man who made his name running the U.S. Senate Finance Committee, long the most corrupt, lobbyist, ravaged panel in all of Washington. Somehow running the U.S. Congress's version of a pay-to-play casino now makes people credible experts in campaign strategy and political morality. Fascinating perspective from David Sirota, one of America's most perceptive writers. 1-866-303-2270. Well, there it is. I'm getting all this noise in my headphones here, and I just figured out which mic was open. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. Bernice in Dearborn, Michigan. Hey, Bernice, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I'm a disenfranchised Michigan Democrat. I wanted to vote directly for John Edwards.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering, do we know who is responsible for moving the Michigan primary forward?
I believe it
was all this travesty.
I believe it was the Michigan Democratic Party.
The Michigan Democratic Party.
But I am not. I am not certain. I don't. I've talked with David a couple times about trying to get somebody from the Michigan Democratic Party on to talk about that. We've not been successful. I frankly don't know the ins and outs of it, and I'm not in Michigan, so perhaps one of our Michigan listeners can enlighten us. But Bernice, that's all I know about it. And the national party said no, and if you do this, this is what'll happen. And apparently, this game of chicken has been played, and on it goes. Dorothy in Washington State. Hey, Dorothy.
Well, hi. Well, this is just about what I was going to mention. It looks to me like the head of the Democratic Party is. In cahoots with the corporations or something, like they're promoting Hillary, and here Wes Clark and Madeleine Albright are her advisors. I don't think she's going to be getting out of the war soon.
Well, frankly, I think she will. But these are people who were part of the Clinton administration. I mean, you know, they've been around the Clintons for a long time, so not a surprise. Ed in California. Hey, Ed.
Yeah, hi, Tom. I'm a very sad, disillusioned person this morning. I will vote for Edwards, if I get a chance, and I'll read David Sirota. My question is a little more fundamental, and that is that I have to start walking my neighborhood. I'm a precinct worker. And, incidentally, in 52, I drove from Boston to Providence, and I voted for Eisenhower for the first 4 years. Since then, I've been dedicated liberal Democrat. Now, the question is this. How am I going to get the people in my neighborhood not to worry about Michigan or that sort of stuff? How am I going to get them convinced to vote? I have to go out and knock on 142 doors, hopefully, and I'll be 82 in July. I mean, I'm sorry, 80 years old in July. Now, the thing is, you gave a beautiful rendition of Eisenhower's platform in 1952. I would love to
have... That was 56, actually. Yeah.
Well, but he first ran in 52.
Right.
And that was terrific, and it was followed by Claudio from Toronto, Canada. How can I could give that to the people whose doors I go and knock on? How could I get a copy of those two segments? You started at 9:42 a.m. with the Eisenhower thing.
Well, there are clips and archives on our website. Also, from time to time, there are transcripts. The 1956 Republican platform, which is what I was reading from when Eisenhower ran for re-election, should easily be Googled. I mean, just Google 1956 Republican Party platform, and I think it should probably pop right up. As far as the caller from Canada, Claudio, you would have to pick up our stream from someplace. There's a bunch of podcasts and things out there. Okay. But, Ed, have you been through the Democracy for America training?
We call it here Go Team. The process I'm involved in is called Go Team from the local Democratic Party.
Okay, so they do have a training in how to knock on doors and how to talk with people and all that kind of thing?
Yes, it's excellent.
Yeah. Great. Well, Ed, thank you so much for participating in the political process, and good on you. 80 years old and still out there knocking on doors. You are my hero for the day. Thank you so much for the call. Great to hear from you. Gary in Detroit, Michigan, listening on WDTW. Hey, Gary.
Hi, Tom. It's a great show. I listen a lot.
Thank you.
I just wanted to let people know that in Michigan, we launched a ballot drive to create a constitutional right to health care in Michigan. And we should have people out at their polling place, but if not, they can go to the website for it, healthcareformichigan.org.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Good. That's up tomorrow. Along, we think that it's a good thing to do because the right-to-work people are trying to steal some rights, and we're trying to give you some.
Yep. And on the ballot tomorrow, are you going to vote uncommitted, Gary, on the Democratic side?
I don't know yet. Probably.
Yeah, good.
Okay. Yeah, I think I will.
Okay. Thanks a lot for the call. Kyle in Michigan. Hey, Kyle, what's up?
Hey, Tom. I was just calling. I'm also from Detroit. I was listening online on airamerica.com. I'm actually going to be going tomorrow to vote in the Republican primary for Ron Paul.
Why?
I'm not a Ron Paul supporter. Obviously, you know, I feel a lot like you do. There's a lot of his stuff that I don't agree with. Pretty much everything on economics.
Yeah, everything except he wants to get out of the war, which all the Democrats do anyway.
Well, yeah. Pretty much, what I think, and this is because I have a neighbor that's, he used to be a Bush Republican, and now he's a big Ron Paul supporter. And basically what I think Ron Paul represents is a huge repudiation of the neocon doctrine of preemptive.
Yeah, but so does the Obama and the Edwards presidential candidacies, and you can vote for those in Michigan by voting uncommitted.
Yeah, I could. The problem, aside from whether or not they'll actually seat the delegates, you know, in Michigan, because they've...
Right. But nonetheless, I mean, if Hillary gets more than 50% of the vote, she's going to claim that she won Michigan, and the press is all going to be saying, oh, look at this, Hillary won Michigan.
I think they handed Michigan to her when they pulled out.
Well, yeah, she kept her name on the ballot, her and Dennis Kucinich and apparently Mike Gravel. I don't have one of the ballots in front of me, but this is what I'm hearing from my callers.
Well, yeah, I mean, just from talking to my neighbors and work, because I do some volunteer work here with a Get Out the Vote campaign, a lot of people who got their ballots early, old people, people in the military, they wrote in a candidate.
Right, which invalidated their ballot.
Right.
Because the original instructions didn't say that your ballot will be invalidated if you put a write-in, and there was a write-in slot, which is just crazy.
Yeah, it didn't even include the original ballot. Didn't even include I'm committed.
Right, right. Yeah, it's just wrong. Kyle, thanks for the heads up, and thanks for the call. Appreciate it. Kathy in Michigan. Hey, Kathy.
Hi. I'm also from Detroit, Michigan, and I'm calling to encourage Michigan voters to vote for Kucinich. He's the most progressive candidate on the ballot, and it's pretty apparent he won't have enough delegates to take the nomination, but I know that he would give his delegates to the candidate that most matches his viewpoints on the issues, and that would be either Edwards or Obama.
Well, that's not what he did in Iowa. He gave his delegates to a Barack Obama, and John Edwards is far and away more clearly aligned with Dennis Kucinich on the issues.
Well, I agree with that. I agree that Edwards is more progressive than Obama,
but either one of them is not Hillary.
Pardon?
Either one of them is not Hillary Clinton. Is that the point?
Right, right.
Yeah.
But I think Kucinich needs support because his views are, you know, for universal health care, for getting out of the war quicker than any of the other candidates, getting out of Iraq. And
Got it, Kathy, and you're right. Jeff in Denver, Colorado. Hey, Jeff, just a minute before the break.
Okay, call about Kucinich, but I do have to mention something about biodiesel. Please look up the Orangutan Film Protection Project. If we choose the wrong way of getting biofuels, it may be a disaster bigger than staying with gasoline.
Yeah, what we need to do is legalize hemp in this country and start growing it.
Hemp would be great. Waste biofuel, great, but virgin stuff, maybe not. Maybe algae is great.
Yeah.
Anyway, about over 99% of the Democrats have still not voted in any primary or caucus, so we really don't know who the leaders are yet. And so in Michigan, I'd say Kucinich, you know, he's clearly the progressive choice. And whether he gets a nomination, as a woman who just called said, his delegates can go to somebody else. But the thing is, 99% of people still haven't voted. We can still have a great change. Huckabee was in the single digits just a few weeks before Iowa.
Yeah. So your suggestion, were you in Michigan, you would be voting for Kucinich just as an anti-Hillary vote, essentially, or
a
progressive
vote? As a pro-Kucinich vote.
As a pro-Kucinich vote.
Absolutely pro-Kucinich.
Okay. All right. Great. Jeff, thanks a lot for the call. Good to hear. Always good to hear from you. 45 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program. We'll be back with more of your calls right after this. 866-303-2270. TomHartman.com if you want to drop into our live chat room. Here's an opportunity for you to listen to the folks who are helping bring this show to you.
This is the Tom Hartman Program, your radio support group for We the People.
Burning up the atmosphere and cutting down the trees. The billion-dollar bombing of a nation on his knees. Anyone not marching to their tune, they call it treason. Everyone says God is on his side. See the lightning, hear the cries of the wounded in a world in holy war. Mortal thunder from the skies, killing everything they say they're fighting for.
9.5 minutes before the hour of the Tom Hartman Program, brought to you in part by the 200,000 health and hospital workers at SEIU 1199, fighting for quality, affordable health care for all Americans. Keeping our families healthy should be a right, not a privilege. And brought to you all by our other many fine advertisers and sponsors. Please listen for their ads and support their products or services. I am looking at the Michigan ballot. And a tip of the hat and thanks to Dinky Dow, who emailed it to me, a PDF of it. And here it is. President of the United States, vote for not more than one. Hillary Clinton, Chris Dodd, Mike Gravel, Dennis Kucinich, uncommitted, and then write-in space. And if you use the write-in space, they will throw away your ballot. It shouldn't even have been there. It's like sabotage. And uncommitted is where you is in Michigan what you would circle if you want your vote to either go for Mr. Obama, Senator Obama, or Senator Edwards. By the way, breaking news and a positive development for Vice President Dick Cheney. As Andy Borowitz notes, scientists in a laboratory at the University of Minnesota, this is true, have created a living rat's heart. So maybe there's hope for Mr. Cheney. Or Mr. Cheney, as he calls himself. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. And Chuck in Long Beach. Hey, Chuck, what's up?
Hi, Tom. This is Chuck in Long Beach. Hillary Clinton has been claiming that her years in politics have honed her diplomatic skills, yet yesterday on Meet the Press with Tim Russert, she used the term Jesuit argument, which is a slur against 23% of the Catholics in the United States. It's like saying woman driver. You just don't say those without slurring women.
Aren't the Jesuits, please understand, I don't mean this as a slur. I'm not a Catholic, but I have a number of friends who went to Catholic school, and you know, and when I was in high school, and my understanding is that the Jesuits are famous for their intellect, for their intellectual curiosity, for their fascination with science, and for their willingness to engage in debate. I thought, am I wrong?
Nope, you're right. That's quite true.
As opposed to some of the other orders that are more like introspective or vows of poverty and things like that. So if that's the case, then using the phrase Jesuit argument would simply mean, somebody who loves to argue or not argue in a negative way, but somebody who likes to make the issues, make the debate, all that kind of thing. How could it be a slur?
That's putting the best possible spin on it. She was using it to disparage something said by Obama by calling it a Jesuit argument.
I see. I think she was trying to argue against Tim Russert, but my recollection may be wrong. But I understand your point. Chuck, thanks a lot for your opinion. Bob in San Francisco. Hey, Bob.
Hi. I think at least we're hearing phrases from Hillary that we wouldn't have heard before Iowa, because she wouldn't have had to even try to get descriptive.
Mm-hmm.
So she has to take some knocks. She's actually using words.
Yeah.
She had
yeah.
a choice. She just...
Well, and Barack Obama is, you know, we're starting to find out about his voting record and as a senator in Illinois and about some of his positions. And, frankly, my guess is if there's a real battle between Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama, the last man standing might be John Edwards.
Yeah, well, I don't know. I'm for Obama. I'll say that up front because... Mm-hmm. I think he can win. I really appreciate Edwards for keeping the door open. You know, two elections running.
Yeah. Well, we'll see. It was over at Think Progress. Let me see if I can get it real quickly here. Yeah. Already again, this, I'm telling you, people have said, you know, if Barack Obama is the nominee, they're going to use the race card against him and it's going to be the Harold Ford Jr. thing all over again. And I've been saying, no, it's going to be the religion card. It's going to be the fact that his middle name is Hussein. Daniel Pipes wrote an essay, "Was Barack Obama a Muslim?" This guy's an advisor to Rudy Giuliani. And he's out there saying right now that Al-Qaeda will want to assassinate Obama because he has left the Muslim faith, which is a way of saying that he was in the Muslim faith to begin with. In other words, it's a backhanded slur. It's a backhanded way slur in the context. Not that being a Muslim is bad, but politically in the United States running for president right now, it would be a liability at the very least. This is what they're doing. They're doing this with this viral email that everybody has seen. It's just this thing has gone. I've gotten so many copies from people. I think it's making Barack Obama very vulnerable because most people don't know him, and the Republicans have already defined him for so many people. Kathy in Michigan. Hey, Kathy.
Hello.
You're on the air. We have about a minute before we have to wrap up the show.
Okay. A statement and a question.
Yeah.
I live in Michigan, and I've already voted on the absentee ballot, and there is a sentence on there about voting uncommitted,
yep.
But it doesn't say why. So I thought all the votes would go like into a hat, and they don't split them up. Anyway, I wanted Edwards. I ended up voting for Kucinich because I wanted my vote to count somewhere.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, probably a lot of people did that, or Gravel or Chris Dodd, if they didn't want to vote for Hillary Clinton. And this is going to be a very interesting one to watch. Alan in Detroit. Alan, you had some insight on Carl Levin.
Yeah, when the Michigan ballot care, the Michigan primary came up, the idea went to the Michigan legislature, and he thought it should come first because Michigan should come to the forefront and be an important state, especially with the state of the economy in Michigan.
Yeah, he was trying to get...
He was pushing it all along.
So Carl Levin was the force behind it. Interesting. Thank you, Alan, for the info. Coming up tomorrow, I'll be shaking it up with Jonah Goldberg about his new book, Liberal Fascism. Roberta McDonald stops by on co-ops in the community, and we'll continue our presidential primary coverage. It's the Tom Hartman radio program. Don't forget, my friends, democracy begins with you. Activism begins with you. Tag, you're it. We'll see you tomorrow.
This is the Tom Hartman program. For exclusive audio archives and more information, visit TomHartmanRadio.com.